Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. When the winner of the National Book Award for Fiction was announced in November, the name of the winner and her book sent many people scrambling to learn more. Jamie Gordon's novel, Lord of Misrule, hadn't received much attention even among reviewers or booksellers. But as the National Book Award judges can attest, it deserved much more notice. The book is set over the course of four so-called claiming races at a West Virginia racetrack in the early 1970s. The horses and the people who inhabit the novel are on the margins of the sport. But Gordon's novel is no longer on the fringes. Gordon, who has taught for nearly 30 years at Western Michigan University, was in Milwaukee recently to talk about and read from Lord of Misrule, and she had time to stop by the Lake Effect studio. Nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Let me start by asking this, because this kind of is the setting for this novel. Can you explain what a claiming race is?
Most of the races at American racetracks are claiming races. This simply means that any horse that runs in this particular race is for sale to any other owner who has run a horse at that particular meeting of that particular racetrack. And that's done so that people who have a horse a whole lot better than all the other horses would not dare run the horse in a $5,000. I mean, there are claiming races up to $25,000 and $35,000 by now, but not on the kinds of racetracks that I'm talking about. It theoretically keeps the race somewhat honest and keeps horses of approximately the same ability, the same class, in the same race. In actuality, racetrackers play with this kind of race as much as they possibly can.
Well, right. The idea is that it's to keep it relatively honest, but I gather there is a lot that goes on that is maybe stretching the bounds of honest.
From the point of view of a racetracker, it's just the game. No one would think of that as out-and-out cheating. You do everything possible to make a horse look a little worse than he is. It's usually a he, not always, on paper, meaning in the past performance charts that handicappers look at. And you do that not only in hopes of getting the purse, but always of cashing a bet. If you think your horse is going to win, well, why not put a little money on the horse and increase your earnings 1, 2, 3, or even tenfold? That's the idea, I think, most of the time.
It seems like the ability to claim each other's horses is kind of yields this balance of power that girds this whole novel, really, if I'm reading that right.
Yes, and apart from the desire to gamble with your horse, meaning to cash a bet after having made the horse look a little different on paper than it actually is one way or another, there's also the anxiety that someone will figure this out, that someone's been watching, that someone will know already or has seen that horse on another racetrack or 100 different ways will figure out what you're trying to do. So anytime you run a better horse for a lower price, you're also sweating that somebody's going to take the horse.
Give us a sense for where the track that you've set this novel, Indian Mound Downs, where does it reside in the horse racing universe?
The actual backside or backstretch of a racetrack that I most had in mind when I was working on this novel was based pretty much on Green Mountain Park outside of Pownall, Vermont, which is the only racetrack I ever actually lived on. That is to say, lived in one of those sardine can trailers with the curtains falling down and
the heat turned up to
tropical
levels.
Exactly. That was where I experienced the racetracker's life through and through. And after I'd had enough of that, I went to graduate school straight from there.
There are obviously other racing novels out there, but this is not, I suppose, a traditional dark horse story. No one is dreaming of winning the Preakness or the Kentucky Derby. Can you talk about what motivates the people in that sphere, the characters in Lord of Misrule and the kinds of people that you base them on?
Desperation, survival. But at the same time, I think that at least some of them are romantics. They were attracted to horse racing in the first place because of the thrill of the thing. And because I have to say that first time that I ever was in the grandstand of a racetrack and watched bettors going to the windows, I thought, this is really interesting. It's not what I thought at all. It just didn't seem to be about money. I had a feeling that it was more about wanting to know somehow how you stand with the powers of the universe. The whole romance of luck is in some way about believing that you are always marked out for something special, and every time that you lose, being sure, how could I have thought even for a minute that I could win? And when you win, oh, well, this is what I was always meant for. I saw people going back and forth between those poles so often. I heard the rhetoric of that all the time. I have to say that I felt right at home among people who thought that way. And I think it was that mentality that I was trying to portray with this book more than anything else.
This is not all that dissimilar from the mentality that keeps people feeding quarters into a slot machine with the thought that, you know, they'll be in the right place at the right time and the bells will go off and luck will be theirs.
It must be the same, although I've never felt the allure of slot machines, and like most racetrackers, I hate slot machines. Well, actually, any racetrack that's been allowed to install slot machines feels more friendly towards them. But for people in states like Michigan that decided not to allow slot machines at the racetrack, slot machines are kind of ruining horse racing. I was just so amazed to think that people weren't there just to look at those horses. They actually just wanted to bet. For me, it's bound up with seeing horses go thundering by on a racetrack, and it just wouldn't be the same experience without that.
Well, and what about the horses themselves? First of all, where are the horses that come to these racetracks coming from? They are horses that are on their way down, right?
Well, an awful lot of horses are thoroughbreds, are bred in the United States, who nobody would even think for a minute had a chance at the races, as horse racing people call the more expensive racetracks like Aqueduct and Liberty Bell and Pimlico and so on. There are some horses that wouldn't even make it at the cheapest racetracks, and they're lucky if they get placed in riding schools, or they might become jumpers or something of the kind. But the horses that really interested me were exactly the ones you're talking about, the spillover horses that are not making it anymore at the races, but still have enough class, enough something to be the better horses at the half-mile racetracks, the cheap racetracks.
There are four horses at the center of this novel, and they each have their own characteristics. But is there a risk you run in psychoanalyzing them or attaching human ideas of self-awareness to them?
I'm sure that any genuine animal psychologist would say that I've overstepped the bounds in every possible direction with this book. But I think horse racing people recognize the types of horses the same way they recognize the types of human beings that I'm talking about in this book. And I have to say I've been so happy to hear from lots of racetrack people that they liked the book. I was a little worried since it had been a long time. I hadn't actually lived on a racetrack since 1970, and the world that I'm describing is definitely the historical moment before butazolidin, an anti-inflammatory agent that's commonly used with racehorses now legally, became legal.
Well, and I think it was no less than the Daily Racing Form that said they thought you really captured the idiom of the racetrack.
I was utterly thrilled by that.
We should at this point give people a flavor for this novel. If there's a passage that you'd like to read for us.
Gladly. The least experienced person on the racetrack in this novel is Maggie. She's maybe the most like the young woman that I was when I worked on the racetrack, although she's certainly an invented character too. At this particular point, she has found a way to work on the racehorses who are in her care that nobody has really told her would be a good thing to do, and yet she's doing it anyway. So around noon, the van finally rolled down the driveway, and she was off in the Grand Prix over the mountains and up the river while Tommy and the van man took the long way, the slow way, dropping and loading horses for racetrackers who paid cash. But what had she done with her morning while she waited in the fly-loud barn for Tommy and the van man? Maggie had found a bottle of eye-stinging Brand X pink wintergreen horse liniment in the Pichot's tack shed, mixed, for all she knew, according to the late Gaston Pichot's secret recipe. And with it and strong fingers, she worked on Pelter, more or less making it up as she went along. Why did she so love the slant-eyed, bump-nosed horse that her hands wished to parse every inch of his famously long back? It was true she had no scientific reason to believe she knew what she was doing, but surreptitiously she did think so. For all her stamina, as a human girl, she knew she was lazy and unambitious except for this one thing. She could find her way to the boundary where she ended and some other strain of living creature began. On the last little spit of being human, staring through rags of fog into the not-human, where you weren't supposed to be able to see, let alone cross, she could make a kind of home. Her hands felt their way blindly along the ridges and canyons and defiles of the spine, the firm, root-spread hillocks of the withers. She rolled her bony knuckles all along the fallen tree of scar tissue at the crest of the back, prying up its branches, loosening its teeth. And it must be having some effect. When she walked Pelter these days, he wasn't the sour fellow he used to be. He was sportive, even funny. She had walked him this morning until the rising sun snagged in the hackberry thicket. As they swung around the barn, she took a carrot from her pocket and gave him the butt and noisily toothed the good half herself. He curveted like a colt, squealed and cow-kicked, alarmingly near her groin. "Okay, okay," she said, and handed it over. She was glad there was no man around just then to tell her to show that horse who was boss. When they were back in the stall and she turned to leave, she found he had taken her whole raincoat in his mouth and was chewing it, the one she was wearing. She twisted around with difficulty and pried it out of his mouth. He eyed her ironically. "Just between us, is this the sort of horse act I really ought to discipline?" she asked him, smoothing out her coat. "I simply incline to your company," he replied.
That is wonderful. Jamie Gordon reading from the National Book Award winning Lord of Misrule. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
There is one source of tension that plays out and largely through the character of Medicine Ed in this book, and that is the kind of tension between science and quasi-science that I think even to this day accompanies horse racing. Speak to where Medicine Ed falls in this book.
Medicine Ed is an old-timey African-American groom from somewhere in South Carolina around Aiken, what's called the Hunt Country now. And his family had people involved in horse racing, even in slavery. His grandfather, Eduardo Salters, was a famous jockey in his day who died in a match race in 1888. So on the one hand, he's known about horses since he was a small child. On the other hand, even in his family, there was some disapproval on one side, so he had to kind of run away to the racetrack when he was an 8-year-old boy, and he hasn't had the opportunity for an education. He doesn't have very much in the way of letters, and he's ashamed of that. But he's a very smart guy who knows everything about horse racing, and he also knows a little bit about root working. He knows a little bit about folk medicine or folk magic, and he's not above applying that to horse racing, although he's found in the past that it's quite a dangerous tool, because once he resorts to it, he's not in perfect control of what's going to happen. He just does it when he desperately needs his luck to change. I wanted to leave it an open question, whether it's really Medicine Ed's goofer powder or some other factor that's causing races to go awry. On cheap racetracks, races go awry all the time, and that's why we have that expression. That's horse racing, meaning you never know.
The only thing to expect is the unexpected.
That's right.
I know it's still a fairly recent development, but has winning the National Book Award changed your life?
Radically. As someone who had the same relation to luck that I just described as being part of the racetrack mentality, I sometimes felt like a bit of a beggar for attention. And the older I got, the harder it was to summon up the energy to keep a room enthralled at a reading, and I was losing my hamminess. But now it's come thronging back because people seem to really want to read this book. And I'm having extreme good luck, and believe me, a lot of luck is involved. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that, hands down, I wrote the one really wonderful, great novel worth remembering in America this last year. I know there are many, many very good books out there, but this time I was really lucky. And now the name of my book and my name next to it will be part of the history of the National Book Award. And even if I never write anything else, which could happen, that will remain the case. So I'm really happy about that.
Do you still get to the track now and then?
There's no track within spitting distance of Kalamazoo, which is probably a good thing for my ever getting anything else done. There used to be one in Muskegon, a couple of hours away. The track that I have the most opportunity to go to is Pimlico, since I'm from Baltimore, and I've still got a brother there. Until recently, my mother was still living in Baltimore. And when I went back to work in earnest on Lord of Misrule, I needed to talk to racetrackers. And my father knew someone who knew someone, and I got to the backside. Pimlico is a wonderful track, and a little financial trouble now for all the reasons that we were just talking about. But that's probably the track that I am the most likely to actually see horses go running by on.
I'm sure this was not your motivation, but there is something of getting this point in horse racing history down on paper that this book fills.
It's a great question, and I have to say that I was really conscious, at least towards the end of the process of writing the book, that there wasn't another, at least I can't think of a single novel about racetrack life at its low end. And when I talked to Andrew Beyer on the telephone, we agreed about that. He also said that he'd called Laura Hillenbrand and said, what are the good novels about horse racing of this kind? And she couldn't think of any. And I had very consciously in mind the model of Leonard Gardner's Fat City, the novel about boxing that I know best, and I think most American writers who like really gritty, grimy realism know Leonard Gardner's Fat City, which is about low-end boxing in Stockton, California, and desperate people who are engaged in it. And I was just kind of hoping that there might be an open niche for that kind of book about horse racing. And so far it looks as though that might be another reason that this book will have some shelf life. I really hope so. And I'm very happy if I could have contributed a book in that sense, just because there needed to be a book about that subject matter to have contributed that book to American Letters.
Jamie Gordon, thank you so much. Congratulations, and hope we'll see you back here again.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was great to be in Milwaukee and great to be here.
Jamie Gordon's latest novel is called Lord of Misrule. It won the 2010 National Book Award for Fiction. Gordon, who teaches at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, was in Milwaukee recently for a reading at Boswell Books. That is the Tuesday edition of Lake Effect. We will update you on the winter storm if circumstances dictate on tomorrow's show. Speaking of which, we want to mention that yesterday's interview with Elaine Schmidt about her book referenced her reading at Next Chapter Bookshop. The weather has already pushed that reading back to February 24th. We also want to mention that today is the deadline for February for entries in Flash Fiction Friday. You can learn more about that at wuwm.com/Flash Fiction Friday. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM and WUWM HD1, Milwaukee Public Radio. Fresh air is next.